You're listening to the HFPA in conversation with Judith Light.
This is Gabriel Lerman with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and this is a new episode of our podcast, In Conversation. We are here with two-time consecutive Tony Award winner and two-time consecutive Emmy Award winner and Golden Globe nominee Judith Light, who has a five-decade career in which she shined in the stage, television, and film. How are you?
I'm very happy to see you. 5 decades, is that what he said?
Yes,
I didn't realize
1977,
that
you started
very good.
I mean, it's more than that, because that's when you started in television.
That's right.
You started in stage way before.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So, let me take the title of one of your most famous shows, One Life to Live, and let me ask you, if I take Judith Light life, is anything that you would change? Is anything that you would do differently?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think there are a couple of things. I think if I had known early on that I didn't have to be so worried or so concerned about all kinds of things in my life, but primarily my career, that things would have unfolded for me in a very substantial way, I think I would have changed the kind of level of fear and worry that I had.
That's because you know things that you didn't know then.
That is true, but I think even for those who are where I was then, and those young people who are starting out, I would say that it will all work out and it will all be fine. And I think I set up systems in place to kind of keep myself protected. And I think that wasn't the best way to operate. Mm-hmm. And so I would also say to them, you don't have to rely on coping mechanisms. This is a very... if you put good people around you, and I've had good people around me all the time, I didn't need to be as concerned as I was.
So I understand that from a very early age, you showed this ability mm-hmm. that you have, that you could cry on just because. So when that was that you discovered that you had this ability, this power, how it happened?
First of all, I wouldn't say that it wasn't, it surprised me. Mm-hmm. And it told me something about myself and the level of feeling that was going on for me as I was growing up. And I discovered it, actually, it happened when I was in a play in fourth grade, which you've just reminded me of. I didn't even remember it. And it was, I was doing a play called The Littlest Christmas Tree. And there was a fight scene in it with this, I was playing a poor girl, and there was a rich girl in the story, and she tried to steal this doll that I had made for myself. And I had such a strong reaction to it that what happened was I burst into tears. And every time that moment came up, we did the play a couple of times, and it was always present and always there. Now, as I got older, I never considered it something that I could do. I just knew that it was something in the depth of my myself, my soul, my being, that I have very deep emotional reactions to things. And so that's how it comes out. But it's never easy. I mean, and it does take a toll on me, particularly when I'm doing a long run of a play. It can get very... I have to take very good care of myself and not just sort of assume that it's going to be there or that it's just a trick or something that will automatically happen.
Mm-hmm. From my understanding, you had a very clear idea that this is what you wanted to do from
a
very early age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And nothing would move you from there.
No. My parents were incredibly supportive. I think they both wanted to be performers. And because they never allowed that for themselves, they knew what the cost would be. And my father was trying to make money. And, you know, my mother was a stay-at-home mom for a while. And then she went out and went to work because we needed her to. But I think it was more that the moment that it happened, I was performing for my father. And I saw his reaction. And I said, oh, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. But it took me a while to get centered enough to not be trying to be a little girl pleasing her father, but actually being a responsible adult and a grown-up in this business. Because I think at some level, one has to stop trying to get approval and go for what our business, I think, really is. And I had to find a new context for the work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I was going to be miserable. Because if you keep looking for approval from somebody, you can't get yourself anywhere, really, that has any kind of depth. And that was when I realized that we're in a service business. Mm-hmm. We're here to serve people. We're here to give people a psychological understanding and an emotional understanding of a character. And we're there to give a performance. And that's what our job is. And once I recontextualized it, everything shifted for me.
Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, you had a very formal education. You went
yes.
to study theater mm-hmm. in college. Mm-hmm.
I wanted that. Mm-hmm. That was something that I said to my parents. I want to do that. I want to get a college education, and I want to go to a school that will give me liberal arts as well as my theater training.
Mm-hmm. What are the tools that education gave you in your career, and what were the things that you learned that you had to forget once you were there?
Oh, such good questions. I learned that this business and this work and this craft that we do is much more complex. I remembered at Carnegie Mellon, which is university, which is where I went to school, in the brochure it said, this program is as rigorous and exacting as theater itself. And at that time I thought, what do they mean, rigorous and exacting? And then I started doing the work there, and I realized that this was going to take a lot more. This wasn't just me loving this work and being good at it. It was something that required a great deal of diligence, a great deal of education, and a great deal of commitment and perseverance that I don't think I was prepared for until I actually went to Carnegie and learned that. What I had to unlearn was the rigidity of all that I had learned, and I had to put back a kind of freedom into my work and let myself go and not be so studied, I guess, for a better word, and recognize that I had the foundation, that I had worked on the foundation, that the foundation was there, and then I had to let all of it go. It's like before a performance, I will do all the work in preparing for the performance, and then when I get to the performance, I have to let it all go and see what else will happen, because mm-hmm. that's the magic of giving it away.
Mm-hmm. I have the impression that when you went from after you finished your studies and you went to Broadway to work, mm-hmm. you didn't experience the usual level of rejection that actors go through, that you were very lucky, you got into theater very quickly?
Yes, but part of that was what they gave you at Carnegie, which was they had these, the theater communications group, which is still around, mm-hmm. had these auditions, and they brought all of the artistic directors from all of the repertory theaters all over the country and in one place. And so I did a preliminary audition in New York, and then I did a final. They accept you or they don't accept you, and then I did a finals audition in Chicago. And all of those repertory theater directors were there. And so when you finish your audition, you have a list that they give you where you go around and you talk to all these artistic directors and they say, we have this season for you. Do you like this? And I had a couple of different places I could go. And that's when I chose the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And then I went to the Seattle Repertory Theater after that. But they provided that kind of support for you. But then when I got to New York, I called the woman who was running the theater communications group, wonderful woman named Rosemary Tischler. Great casting director in New York. And Ro, I called her, and she had been great support for me. And I said, should I come to New York now? I'd been in repertory theater for about 4.5 years. And she said, yes, it's time for you to come. And she said, and I can help you. She said, I'll give you a place in this play that we're doing. I'm going to give you a tiny part. And it was in the play Doll's House with Sam Waterston and Liv Ullmann. Mm-hmm. And so I went to something. But after that, I started auditioning for things, and I didn't get them. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really just this sort of, you know, go to Carnegie, go to Repertory Theater, you know, go to New York, be in your first Broadway show for Joe Papp, and then, you know, with a star like Liv Ullmann, and then it didn't happen like that. And that was really disheartening mm-hmm. and difficult because I had expected it to keep coming like mm-hmm. that. And when it didn't, I thought, I need to make a different kind of choice. Because it wasn't satisfying to just know that I was going to keep going from theater piece to theater piece and go to Canada and do a play. Lovely as it was, that wasn't the life that I wanted. I knew that I wanted a different depth and substance to my life, and I wanted to find a way to give. Mm-hmm. And it seemed so just completely self-involved, and it wasn't of interest to me in that way. Mm-hmm. And though I thought, well, maybe I'll quit. I'll learn sign language and teach deaf children theater, or I'll go into psychology or something. I was just, so it wasn't really always that. I mean, I know from outside sometimes you look at it and you go, oh, that person did really well, but it wasn't ever thus.
But when talking up to the Liv Ullmann play, I think that you were young. You didn't know how the world works. You didn't know how this business works. So you probably had the idea that up to that point that this was a walk in the park.
Yes.
That you will go straight to get the Tony. You know?
Yeah.
Was like that. I mean, and how hard was a slap in your face when you discover this is not this way?
Well, it was really hard. It was really a slap in the face. And I didn't handle it well. I had two things going on at the same time. One was that I was really caught up short by it and upset by it. And the other part of it was that I was having a temper tantrum. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be easy. I wanted it to be the way I wanted it to be, and it wasn't that way. And it's like, wait a minute, I had to grow up. And that was really the essential and important part of my learning. Mm-hmm.
I can imagine you as a trained actress that you coming from Liv Ullmann, coming from Broadway, suddenly with this offer for One Life to Live. Because I come from the same background.
Oh, you do?
At your age, I would have thought the same. I will be like, oh no, I never will do a soap opera.
Right?
Never. I will
kill myself, right, exactly.
But I think that was what opened your career to a new level. So can you walk with me? How was that process of learning that was not so terrible and that you could learn from the experience?
It wasn't about my career any longer. It was about who I was going to be as a human being. Mm-hmm. Because that's, as you know, this is our instrument. This is what we have. This is our violin. This is our cello. This is what we play. And if you are a person who only thinks about your career first, this was in my case. It made me very unhappy. I knew I needed to make a different choice to be a different human being. And my disdain for the soap opera and for the sitcom was all about thinking that the world owed me a different kind of career. Well, I didn't want to be that person. And when One Life to Live came to me, I thought to myself, if I can stop thinking about myself that I have to be only doing theater and only doing feature films, it's a very sophomoric way to think. And I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be a person who looked down at anyone else in our business and say, their work is not worthy. That's not who I want it to be. So when that came to me, I thought, I can bring my theater training, because all of the directors on One Life to Live all came from the theater. And I said, I can actually maybe bring the theater training that I have to this work. And maybe I can find a way to make it be different for myself, for everybody else around me, and also for the people who are watching it. And in making that choice to be that person, everything turned around. And that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So it was who I would be first, then what I would do, and what choice would I make. But it came out of that place.
Was it easy? I mean,
no.
You being, but what I mean is, you were a trained actress, come on, and you had to do this. Were that easy, or was hard?
It was, look, I mean, doing a soap opera and the way that I did it and the character that I did, I mean, I was on almost every day of the week, and, you know, you're learning 50, 60 pages a night. It's really challenging. But I no longer look down at anybody who did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that work, that anybody could make that work. I mean, the writers, the producers, the directors, everybody, that's an hour of television every single day. So yes, it was really hard. It's very hard work. Mm-hmm. But I had learned mm-hmm. at Carnegie that the business would be as rigorous and exacting as this actually was. And it trained me. It gave me discipline. It taught me how to bring something quickly to a scene, also to a cold reading that I was doing and an audition. So I had a lot of pieces of doing the soap that trained me. But was it easy to sort of go in? No. No. It was really a challenge. And I don't know how to read teleprompters. So if I wouldn't remember the line, I didn't know how to look at the teleprompter and try to figure it out. I couldn't do it. So I had to memorize everything. Mm-hmm. So that made it even more difficult. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't trade it for anything.
And that soap brought you a couple of things.
Yeah.
Brought you a couple of awards. Mm-hmm. And also brought you into the living rooms of the people. I mean, yeah. Before people would have to pay a ticket, go sit, mm-hmm. watch mm-hmm. you, maybe...
Maybe
you
not.
Maybe you meet one or two that saw the play, mm-hmm. but television is different mm-hmm. in that sense. And you become famous to many people. Mm-hmm. So how that impacted in your life?
I didn't know the power of television until then. I didn't know the power of being connected to the audience in that way. And to this day, there's a large demographic that has followed me because these are very, very faithful, supportive fans. And they followed me from then until now. And so I just had no idea how that would impact me, how the way they related to me would impact on me and my life, and have subsequently followed me to Who's the Boss, and then followed me to Law and Order SVU, and followed me to Ugly Betty, and followed me all the way through, and come to the theater performances. So it's where it began. So I cherish it. And a lot of people say, don't talk about the soap, don't talk about it. So why? It changed everything. Mm-hmm. I was transformed in relating to it and mm-hmm. transformed by them, mm-hmm. by the fans.
Mm-hmm. And when you did theater, did you do any comedy or were all dramas?
Mostly the things that I have done since I went back to Broadway, and then last year or year and a half ago, I did a one-person show, and that was also dramatic. So I haven't done... I used to do, in repertory theater, I did comedy, okay. But I haven't really done a lot of comedy Some of the stuff in other desert cities was funny. Mm-hmm. She was a complex character, and that was funny, but not really focusing on a comedy. Same with Assemble Parts. No, I would say, you know, mostly dramatic roles.
So my question is, when you changed and you went to a completely new territory and you went into Who's the Boss, was something unfamiliar to you, or did you knew a bit how to?
No, it wasn't unfamiliar, because my parents were both very funny people. Oh. And so, you know, comedy is either instinctive for you, or you get an ear for it in some way. And I think I always had an ear for it. And I had done comedies when I was at Carnegie, and I did comedies in repertory theater. But when I worked with Tony Danza, Tony Danza taught me about comedy. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the greatest learning experiences that I had. He knew and showed me, demonstrated for me, how to really hold for a laugh. And what that could be, and how that could take a laugh not only from one laugh, but into this rolling laughter. And I learned a tremendous amount from him. Mm-hmm. And also Catherine Hillman, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in general, how much you enjoy that, years?
I love it. I love it. I loved Who's the Boss. It was another one of those things that I said that I would never do. I mean, it's like you know, you go, I'm sure you said the same thing. I'm never going to do a soap opera. I'm probably never going to do a sitcom, right?
I didn't have that chance, but.
But yeah. You know what I'm saying. It's like, here are the things, here are the things I'm going to do. Here are the things I'm not going to do. Mm-hmm. This is what my career is going to look like. Well, that's like, you know, who was it? Was it John Lennon who said, you want to make God laugh? Tell her your plans. You know, there's no, you can't. It doesn't serve you. It didn't serve me to cut myself off from all of these things. And I had an instinct that when I took them, it was the right thing to do. I think it's important, and I've always lived by this, or not always. I have moved myself into it. I think doing what you want is one level. I prefer to do what works. I don't think about what I want. I want to do what works. And if I have an instinct about something, that this is being brought to me for a particular reason, I will do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did a play on Broadway called Lombardi, and we did it from, it was supposed to, not going to last very long, but I did it. I knew it was right. People said to me, don't go up for it. It's too small a part for you. You shouldn't be doing it. And I just knew that it was right for me to go up for it. And I got it. And I got my first Tony nomination. Mm-hmm. It's like there's a listening that has to happen that I have learned over time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were in these two big shows, and then you were in many other big shows. But you also went to shows that didn't last a season. Mm-hmm. How do you survive that? How do you survive starting something with the same enthusiasm that these other ones? Mm-hmm. And then you are told, no, this is not going to continue.
Again, if your context is to be a grown-up in the business, you know, most people say they want to be a grown-up, but they don't want to grow up. Mm-hmm. But if you say, oh, I see, there's a sense in which there are things that are, I don't mean this in a sense of fate or meant to be, or there's a sense in which I think if one believes in the friendliness of the universe, that if you think the world and the universe is a friendly place, that things are always working out. And there's a wonderful philosopher named Kierkegaard who said, life can only be lived going forward, but it can only be understood looking backward. Mm-hmm. And when I look back on the things that fell by the wayside, or when the agents called and said, oh, you got the job, and then they called back a few hours later and said, oh, we called the wrong person.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, those things are there to strengthen us if we use them that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can have one context, which is to get depressed and feel miserable and feel like a victim, or you can say, okay, I'm moving on. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these things don't work out, but if you look back on them, they have not worked out for a particular reason. And that's what I always try to keep a hold of in my mind as I'm moving through life, as I'm going forward.
Mm-hmm. So you left the theater, you went into television, you did these amazing shows, but then you left the theater. You really left the theater.
I left and stayed
away for 22 years.
Yeah.
How did you survive?
Thank you for doing your homework. You're so sweet.
Well, thank you, but...
How do you survive?
Not going to the stage for 22 years.
But I got caught up. Mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree, as more time went on, I got more and more afraid that I didn't know that I could do it anymore. And when I was given the part to take over in this play called Wit, from a wonderful, wonderful actress in New York, Kathleen Chalfant, when they gave me the part, I essentially thought I'd lost my mind, going back to face the New York critics, shaving my head, doing it. They wouldn't let me do it in New York unless I did it, said that I would do it on the road as well. So I did it for about 10, 11 months. How I was bald, and at the end of the play, I'm naked. Now, when you decide to go back, it's like, that's a pretty drastic way to go back. But I knew, again, it was the same instinct. I knew it was the thing that I had to do. And how I lived was, I had a wonderful life. I was doing a job I loved, working with people I loved, and so I wasn't thinking about it. And I was afraid to challenge myself. Because after Who's the Boss was over, I was given a play to audition for at the Pasadena Playhouse, mm-hmm. A play by a wonderful writer named Jonathan Tollins, who did Buyer and Seller. Did you see that play in New York? Mm-hmm. Did you ever see it? Charming, charming piece. And it was called If Memory Serves. And I was like, oh, no, no. No, this is a part about an aging sitcom star. No, this is not right for me. And my manager at the time, who has since passed away, Herb, said to me, oh, it's the perfect part for you. And he said, you're terrified. I said, you don't know what you're talking about. And of course, he knew exactly what he was talking about. I was terrified. Mm-hmm. And so I went, I said, okay, the next thing that I get an audition for, I will go up for it. And it happened, I had to fly to New York, and it was this play. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go for it, but they're never going to cast me. Well, they did. And mm-hmm. so I went on to do that. So I stayed away, to answer your question, because I was too frightened, in a sense, to go back.
And when you came back after these experiences in television, were you a better actress, do you think?
That's a really interesting question. I think the thing that made me better was that I confronted the fact that I didn't know what I thought I had known. And it was very humbling for me. And by looking at that and not trying to be this big, fancy, dancy, you know, television person that comes back onto the scene, into the theater, I knew I needed support. I needed guidance. I needed to work on my voice. I hadn't worked on my voice in years. So I went to an opera teacher, and she never let me sing. She just worked with me on my breath control. But I had to recognize that I didn't know a lot, that I'd forgotten a lot, that I had something in there that I remembered at some cell level memory. But I don't think that was the gift for me, was that I knew that I didn't know, and that I had to admit that. And that scared me. Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to theater was great because you won the Tony twice,
yeah.
consecutive, mm-hmm. and you were the only third one to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody had done it after you. I'd be wrong. I may be wrong on
I
that.
Don't but I don't think so. Alan might know better than me. I don't think anybody did, so babe, right? Yeah.
So what kind of satisfaction and pressure that gives you to winning twice consecutively?
Oh, it's such a thrill. It's so... Here's the thing about it, is that I left for so long, like you say, and then I came back, and I was welcomed by that community in the most generous, warm, loving, come on back, come on in, you know. And what I did in turn was I proved to them that I wanted to be there, that I wanted to be back there and do that. So that was the thing for me. It was just that it wasn't just coming back. It wasn't just the pressure of having won the Tonys or anything like that. It was what I focus on all the time now is the kind of generosity of the community. And I think to myself, when I see somebody who's come from my position back into the theater, how can I welcome them? How can I be warm to them and make them feel good and comfortable? And I do think about, you know, in my choosing of the next project, the next mm-hmm. theater thing that I do, I did the next thing I did was Off-Broadway. It was a one-person show, something I'd never done before. Terrified me. But I don't know what the next play will be. I mean, I've been reading a couple of things and I've been seeing what they might be. But the pressure is on what might I choose next. That's where I feel some of the pressure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have not too much time and too many things to talk about. But so let me summarize in some of your TV shows that you did after that. Mm-hmm. And it seems that you had a very social conscience at the time of choosing projects, because you participate at least in two that may had a big effect in society, like Ugly Betty,
mm-hmm.
That gave voice to the Latino community.
Absolutely.
And Transparent, who mm-hmm. gave voice to the trans community. Mm-hmm. Was that a decision? Were you searching for those projects, or they just happened? I mean...
No, I wasn't searching for those projects, but I always hold my advocacy as the kinds of characters that I choose to play as something that's very important to me. My choosing, like I said before, what is the next thing that's the thing that is intuitively right and worth bringing to the audience, you know, to have that kind of conversation. And those things came to me. And that's what I mean by the universe unfolds in ways that, you know, so many people say to me, what do you want to do next? What do you want to do next? And I say, if I had tried to orchestrate what has happened for me, I could never have done that in a million years. And so I happened to meet Silvio Horta. And I did a pilot for him that didn't get picked up by ABC. And he looked at me after that and he said to me, I will put you in something else. And man of his word, along comes Ugly Betty, Betty La Fea, and we go to town. I wasn't in the pilot, but right after the show won the Golden Globe, he called me and he said, here's the part. This is what I want you to do. So it's about relationships to me, and about meeting people and how you formulate those kinds of connections as you stay open.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, I didn't. It just, they came to me. Mm-hmm. And, yes, they fit in with the world that I like to operate in. I think playing all different kinds of women is extremely essential to me, mm-hmm. what I can bring to those women.
But you have been an amazing advocate for the gay community.
I have.
Mm-hmm. And you have given so much time to the fight against AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are cast in Transparent.
I know.
Is it a coincidence, or they were looking at this?
No, I don't. It's interesting. I don't think they were. I don't think that was, I mean, I think they found out afterwards mm-hmm. about my advocacy, mm-hmm. but I don't think that was a measure of, it may have been, I mean, you'd probably have to talk to Jill about that, but I don't think that that was where that was coming from. I think it was just part of this whole picture, and then I don't call it magic, but I think that it's this sort of placeholder in the universe where things occur. Mm-hmm. And I think the more, and that's why I love to talk to young people, because they're our legacy. They are our gift, our ongoing gift to the future of mm-hmm. our business. Mm-hmm. And I say, if you stay open, things will come to you. And I don't mean that by magical thinking or this new age stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a real sense of allowing oneself to work diligently, persevere, mm-hmm. respectfully, love and be honoring of the team that you work with, no matter what space that's in, and also be prepared for anything. And so these things have come, I think partly because I hold the world that I am in and my life in those ways.
Mm-hmm. But when you joined Transparent, it was this really small show that didn't have too much chances of anything.
I know.
And then, boom.
I know. But it was also part of the zeitgeist of what was happening, because the transgender community was beginning to really come out of the shadows mm-hmm. at that time. And there were a lot of other things that were happening in relating and in relationship to the trans community. And I think it happened that the arrow had been shot, and we rode also as part of the arrow into the world. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't treat people. You can't hold people as the other mm-hmm. and expect to have a world that works for everyone. Mm-hmm. That you cannot believe that that people who don't look the way that you do or live the way that you do, mm-hmm. that they are less than you. And I think we are in a cultural moment where that is a highlight of the way we're seeing the way that the world works. And I think when you have art that we have the availability to do and to change the conversation, change the culture, talk about immigration, mm-hmm. that where we have that opportunity to do that in our art, I consider that a privilege. Mm-hmm. And we're here to really change. That's why I love the Hollywood Foreign Press, because you are a group of everyone, all different kinds of people from all over, mm-hmm. and you represent the world. And when we are trying to change a culture, I believe it's the art, in every aspect of the arts, that actually does change that. And I think in many ways you all represent that, and that's why I love talking to you. Mm-hmm. It's very important to me, the way we treat each other. It's so, I mean, I watched how the gay community had been discounted, dismissed, and treated so divisively. We must never do that. Mm-hmm. The way the Jews were treated during the Holocaust, we must not do these things. We must take care of our young people and in the schools, in relation to guns. And there are all of these issues that can be presented in ways in the world mm-hmm. through the arts. Mm-hmm. And I feel that it's been one of my greatest gifts to be able to have that kind of trajectory in my life and my career.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in your career, I mean, stage was wonderful, film, television is wonderful, but I have the feeling that in film, you didn't have a real opportunity Mm-mm. to do what you have done in these other mediums. Do you feel the same?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. And I'm very glad you said something about it. It's interesting because I literally I've just been, every single time I'm not one of those people that, you know, like you said, oh, it looked like it came easy or I was lucky or something. I've had to really be diligent about focusing myself on something. So like when I wanted to, when I said, I think television is where maybe I need to be, I started focusing on that and then these things came. And then I went back to the theater and I focused on that because I had said to my darling publicist, Alan Nerup, who I've been with since 1986, hello.
Great.
He's phenomenal. It's true. But I used to say to Alan all the time when I was on Who's the Boss, I used to say, hey, like, can you get me on the Tonys? He said, my darling, you're not facing reality. You haven't been back to the theater. You have to do this. So when I focused on it, I got myself to a place where I focused on it. Now what I'm doing is I'm saying I haven't had the opportunity to do films. And all of a sudden, last year, I was talking to somebody, and he said to me, he said, you need to go to the Sundance Film Lab. I said, I do? He said, yeah, you need to do this. And it's Jay Duplass. And he said to me, yeah. And so literally a week later, a film came to me. And I'm going to shoot that film this summer with these two gals who are writers at the Sundance Film Lab. And I'm going to do another film as well. And I can't talk about those yet, but I will be able to at a certain point. We can come back together and talk about them. But all of a sudden, and it's, again, I want to be really careful for anybody listening out there. It's not about magical thinking. It's about a devotion and a dedication towards seeing something where something might be missing. And then how do you put a team together to support you in that vision? Because we never do this alone. This is, I mean, it's like I could talk about all these things in my bathroom and nobody would ever hear this. But you come and we talk about it and then people hear about it. It's the same thing. It's a team effort to me. So that's what I'm looking at right now.
Okay, your part in the Versace story is quite short, but very interesting. What attracted you to participate in the show?
Tom Robb Smith is a writer of great account. And Ryan Murphy is a producer of extraordinary ability. And there were a couple of other people that were there, Brad Simpson and Nina Jacobson, and they were all working on this. We had a hair, makeup, and wardrobe team that helped me make that character and the script, and working with Mike Farrell, who was just astounding. And I thought it was such an interesting story culturally as to how this young man had been so closeted and then closeted by his parents, closeted by the culture, and that the way the world looked at him and treated him pushed him to kill more people. Versace was the end result of what happened to that young man. And so I found that very interesting. A wonderful director, a woman named Gwyneth Horder-Payton, directed me in most of it. And then there was a guy named Dan Minahan who directed me after that. But all of those pieces were incredibly compelling, and yes, it was very short. And originally, it was only that third episode, and then they wanted to tie it in at the end, so they put me back into the ninth episode, and so they expanded the part, and they thought it would be a great counterpoint to what was happening with Cunanan on the boat before he killed himself, and watching himself, and as he went crazier and crazier, to see the balance of this woman who was holding it all together as best as she could.
What is impressive is how reality is stranger than fiction. I mean, the real story that what your character was through is impressive. That I went and I checked. Is this really happened?
And yes, yes, yes. And the murder of her husband, Lee Miglin, was even more gruesome than they showed on the show. And it was pretty gruesome. But yes, they were really well-known people, and it's just a devastating story. And I think that Ryan felt that it was a very important piece of the story that people didn't really know about who had been murdered prior to the killing of Versace. That's why they did it backwards, which I thought was genius. Mm-hmm.
Still shows that he was real, really cruel with that man. Yeah.
Oh, there's no question. But he was his own. You know, we talk about our psychology and how we understand ourselves. And if we will look at ourselves and understand how we operate in the world, all of that was a projection onto every one of those people that he killed was his own wanting to murder this part of himself. I mean, that's a very simplistic psychological, you know, diagnosis, but you can see that the vitriol, the hatred that he felt toward himself was taken out on those people. And most people don't know how many killings happened prior to Versace. You know, we all heard about Versace, and it was like, okay, but we didn't know what happened prior to that. And he kept being more and more emboldened as time went on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's very creative is going backwards.
Yes,
right?
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So it was a great honor to do it. And I just did a photo shoot yesterday. With Edgar Ramirez and with Darren Criss, and we were just recounting our experiences having worked on the show and how supportive that atmosphere is. I mean, Ryan creates a world that you walk into and everybody is a part of it. So I was talking about before about a team. Everybody's on the team. Everybody's there to support everybody else. And that's why, partly why I think the work that he does is so extraordinary.
So we have like 4 minutes or something like that, and I need to get personal. There is this question, hard question I have to ask you. You made a conscious decision not to have kids.
Yes.
Just to devote yourself to your art. There are days that you regret that.
No. No, I don't. And I always look at it. It's not something, and friends of mine now are, you know, people that I consider my children are having children now. And it was interesting. My aunt and uncle, my mother's older sister and her husband, they were a model for me. They had this extraordinary life, and they never had children. And my husband and I discussed it, and we said, we're working so much right now that, and I think having children is a sacred venture. And I would want to give all to that. I would not be the kind of mother who would say, I'm going to be right there. I know you have the ballet recital. I've just got to finish this one scene and I'll be there. I wasn't willing to bring a child into the world and have other people bring them up. Have help, yes. But Robert and I talked about it and we both said, where we are in our careers right now, let's make this choice. And as we get older and we're not able to have children, how are we about adopting? Would we be open to that? And we said, yes, absolutely. And we still check in with each other about that now. We say, where are you at about this? What do you think now? And what's happened is that he and I are working more now. He's become a writer now, and we're working on a project together. So we're working more now than we were before. So we're still at the same place. But we also have a lot of children in our lives, and it fulfills us in that way. But I asked my aunt once and my uncle, and I said, did you ever regret not the choice to not have children? And they said, no, we never did. And they gave us sort of that template to follow. But I really do mean it. I think it's a sacred and holy job that I would want to be fully there for.
So let me close this with this personal question.
Oh, my.
You have been with Robert for many, many years.
37.
What are the pros and the cons of being married to a fellow actor?
Well, he's not really an actor anymore, so that makes a big difference. But what has happened is that I'm married to someone who, no matter what happens, he stays in the room and he will discuss anything with me. So when my career took off in ways that his did not, we would be at a function and he would say, afterwards we'd get in the car and he'd say, "Ooh, tonight was hard for me." And we would talk about it. And I would say, "I hear you. I get it." The pros are that he understands. He understands, like, I'm in New York most of the time. He comes to visit me when I'm doing a play. So when we're doing that, he understands what I have to do. So that's the cons are really not so much, except that, you know, we're not together all the time. Maybe that's some of it. But we found a way to make it work, and I think our relationship is better than it's ever been.
Judith, has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
And likewise, and thank you.
The HFPA in Conversation is executive produced by Kirpi Wimonen, produced by Lorenzo Soria and Matt Smith. This episode hosted by Gabriel Lerman. Editing by Matt Smith. Music by Cameron Chambers for the HFPA. Logo by Jason Little for the HFPA. Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. Follow us on social media at Golden Globes. The HFPA in Conversation is a production of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which owns all rights in the recording.